Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Hello and welcome to another Yale Journal for International Affairs podcast. I'm Rebecca Tucholsky, the new podcast host for the upcoming academic year. Today, we'll be talking about demystifying the Islamic Republic of Iran from the inside and what the new American administration could mean for human rights and democracy in the country. I'm joined today by Dr. Nina Ansari and Vahid Abedini. Vahid is a democracy activist and organizer who has been involved in Iranian student movement as well as the Green Movement in 2009. Vahid has organized thousands of people to promote a more transparent, democratic process. He is now a PhD student at Florida International University in Miami, where he has also done some organizing for Iranian immigration rights. Dr. Nina Ansari is the daughter of a former Iranian ambassador to the U.S., a multiple award-winning author, philanthropist, Columbia scholar, and professor at the London School of Economics Center for Women, Peace, and Security. She has been profiled by the New York Times as one of the five Iranian women visionaries you need to know. Dr. Ansari's book, Jewels of Allah, The Untold Story of Women in Iran, is considered the seminal work on women's rights in Iran, with 100% of the book's proceeds donated to charities supporting women in Iran. Hello to you both, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, Rebecca. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me, too.
So let's start with a question for you, Nina. Your work focuses on women's roles surrounding the rise of the Islamic Republic. Can you give us a bit of a view into what it's been like to live in the Islamic Republic since that time? What have been some of the primary restrictions placed on citizens and women in their daily lives?
Rebecca, you're primarily looking at a society with patriarchal precepts that are embedded in the Islamic constitution, which effectively shrouds the overall status and women in restrictions. From the Islamic Civil Code to the preamble to the Constitution, you have a society where Iranian women are by and large restricted in both their personal and public lives, including state-enforced dress codes, job opportunities, sporting activities, which are open to them, and essentially freedom of movement under controls requiring a husband's signature to leave the country.
That's quite a lot.
That was just a little bit.
In your book, you talk about the problem with popular narratives and how, despite their seemingly convincing half-truths, the real story is much more complicated, nuanced, and less tidy. What are some of these misconceptions that people commonly have about Iran?
You know, in general, Rebecca, I feel that we're all guilty of viewing the history of a particular country in which we have very little familiarity in very black and white terms, particularly countries with thousands of years of a convoluted social, political, and historical landscape, Iran being one of them. So even though Iran has been in the news for decades now, the familiarity that the general public has with Iran is really disseminated via mainstream media. So you're getting a very, very partial look at a country that is really, in essence, going through a battlefield of sorts and has been for some time. So I'll just give you a few of the misconceptions. One that I continuously dealing with is that, you know, the perception that there's not much of a women's movement in modern-day Iran. So that, again, has to do with the lack of coverage it receives in mainstream media. But today, with social media and Twitter, it is picking up and getting more attention than it has in previous years. And the whole idea is the more attention the plight of women gets in the international community, the more pressure international human rights organizations can put on Iran from the outside. That is, you know, one of the biggest misconceptions that I deal with, is that there's not much of a women's rights movement in Iran. And predominantly also the mandatory headscarf for women has also affected the perception that a lot of outsiders have regarding women's rights in Iran. But what's important to realize is that most women don't subscribe to wearing the headscarf. It is something that is mandated by law, but it also serves the paradoxical purpose of allowing women in positions of power, the very few that do actually have positions of power, to be accepted and taken in to the fold of a patriarchal mm-hmm. society.
Could you talk a little bit more about the shape and character that the current women's movement has taken in the last few years?
You know, the women's movement is ongoing, and when I say ongoing, it's that they do make incremental and small strides. By that I mean when something is ongoing, it means that it is gaining momentum, but it's consistently faced with obstacles, given the fact that even though Iran does have a moderate president, that moderate president is actually in many ways severely handicapped by a supreme leader who is beholden to antiquated views of women and the role of women in an Islamic society. So as long as there's a supreme leader that by and large continues to advocate that a woman's primary role and responsibility within an Islamic society is within the private sphere, you have a tug of war going on. What you're dealing with is a very young female population, a very highly educated female population, not to mention a defiant female population. So you have a battlefield of sorts going on between the ruling conservative echelon and this new generation of women. You know, just recently, the Supreme Leader claimed that gender equality is actually a Western misconception, and more so, he said it's a Zionist plot aiming to corrupt the role of women in society. So these are the many challenges women are faced with, not to mention what I said earlier, which are all the gender discriminatory laws which are embedded in the Constitution and in the fabric of society in general.
I want to bring Bahid into this conversation a little bit because he's been actively involved in this kind of organizing. So I want to first ask you, Bahid, about your experience in participating in that organization process and about your perceptions of kind of this moment in Iranian history in terms of political participation.
Actually, I have been involved in student movement and green movement for about 2 decades. And to be honest, it's not an easy job being active in societies like in Iran because of different elements. To be honest, it's not a country like Switzerland or any other free country. That's why lots of people prefer not to be involved in politics, criticizing the government, or especially advocating for democracy. One of the main points here is that the government has strong authoritarian trends, especially in some part of that. And they try to use every means at hand to suppress democratic movements. They arrest people, they summon to the courts, they put pressure on them. They have to be strong to resist against these pressures. On the other hand, it's the point that Iran is kind of, at least, has some religious and traditional part. And you should be aware how you should behave toward them, not to provoke them against democratic values. And it's really a tricky job, and it needs plan and strength.
I agree with Vahid, if I can interrupt,
please.
That this is... the solution is not very easy because you're dealing with so many different cultural dynamics as well. So you have in general, and I think Vahid would be better able to explain this, you have these this battlefield of sorts going on in Iran between the conservative and moderate factions, between a very young population that yearns for freedom. So the other thing is it's difficult when you think that, you know, you want maybe what's best for the people of Iran, but you also don't want to provoke a regime that always seems to turn on its own people. So it's a very difficult landscape to navigate.
Thanks for that. Nina, you've mentioned twice now this concept of a difference between the generations in Iran, and that comes very close to the kind of research that Vahid is doing right now. So I want to turn to you, Vahid, and ask you to tell us a little bit more about this generational gap between kind of the revolutionary generation and the generation that's coming of age now.
Yeah, that's part of my research. I focused on the changes that's happening in Iran regarding their political attitudes and their worldview, especially. The wrong image of Iran is that the stereotype is students who captured the U.S. embassy in Tehran in the 1980s. This stereotype is not correct anymore because we are facing another Iran. Those generation, revolutionary generation, has changed a lot, first of all, and secondly, they are passing away. They are in the 60s, 70s, 90s. So this is not the way we have to see Iran. First of all, as I said, those revolutionary people during these four decades has changed a lot. They faced lots of realities in the world. They were revolutionaries, idealistic at first, and they tried to change the world. But after a while, after four decades of ruling, at least some part of them came to this reality that it is not correct. We cannot do that. And we see some of them, we call them reformists or moderates. For example, this government administration of Rouhani's moderate. These people has changed a lot. And sometimes they say that, okay, we made a mistake, lots of mistakes regarding our actions. For example, hostage crisis. But the most important part is here that we have a young population. Iran is a young country. We have more than 70% under 40. They were born around the revolution or after the revolution. They have no idea of the image of Shah regime or U.S. presence or interventions in Iran that usually revolutionary people had in mind. That's why when we ask these people, this new generation, who is the enemy? They usually do not say the United States. The old generation said, revolutionary people always said, okay, the enemy is the United States and we have to do against it. But this new generation is really different regarding this perception of the U.S. and these policies. Because of that, you can see that all Western journalists or tourists who go to Iran are shocked because at first they think that the people might hate them, but after a while they say, okay, these people love us, and they write about hospitality and the kind behavior of Iranian people. It's related to this change that has happened during these four decades.
And Nina, to what extent is that consistent with the kind of generational gap that you see in the women's movement?
Rebecca, the women's movement, I don't see much of a generational gap. What's happened in the women's movement is, again, I'm going to touch on part of what Vahid mentioned, which is the older generation of women, religious women in particular, who supported Khomeini initially and came to regret it given their post-revolutionary status within an Iranian society. Those women have actually been very instrumental. You have to realize these are the women who raised this new generation mm-hmm. of women. They're the mothers of these women. So these women, they may be the older generation beholden to Islam, but adhere and embrace a more progressive interpretation of the laws that the conservative echelon have interpreted to mean a woman's secondary position, an inferior position in society. The daughters of this generation, as Vahid said, are among the young generation that are very pro-West, that are very open towards embracing the U.S. and the outsiders. I see this all the time on social media, where there's nothing but kindness and a really strong desire to have Iran open its doors and come out of isolation.
That reminds me of a story that Vahid told me recently regarding a moment celebrating the anniversary of the revolution in Iran. Can you tell me a little bit about that moment, Vahid, and what it meant?
Yeah, I'm I mentioned that recently, some months ago, the anniversary of revolution in Iran happened, and I was seeing that how people signs were different from the old years. It was kind of interesting for me that they had some signs saying that Iranian welcomes the Americans or thank the U.S. for supporting Muslims in the U.S. It was mentioning the changes has happened recently in the United States politics regarding the Muslim ban and other things. I think it seems that Iranian, even in religious parts, are looking at the United States differently. Before that, they had a unique and total understanding of the United States. But nowadays, they are thinking as the United States, as a society like other societies. There are lots of fractions, lots of people, lots of different groups. So they are challenging for their interests, and they are not all enemies. So it was kind of interesting for me that even in those parts, they are recognizing the differences in the United States politics.
So, Wahid, I also wanted to ask you, with this enormous change in the United States' view towards the Middle East, what other effects do you think the new administration might have on the way that the movement that you work with, the reformist movement, may perceive the United States in the coming years?
Yeah, that's not an easy job for the U.S. doing that. To be honest, I was working on a paper recently on the how the United States was behaving toward Iran and how it affects democratic movements in Iran. We have some negative moments in this history, especially when the CIA helped overthrowing the Mohammad Mossadegh democratic elected government. Or even during the after revolution, 1979 revolution, democracy was not the first priority of the United States. Of course, it was the Cold War, and always the United States had different strategic policies. But even in recent years, for example, after 9/11, when Iran had a reform movement, the U.S. policy, or even I can say President Bush, putting Iran as a member of Axis of Evil was kind of a mistake that kind of helped the military people in Iran kill the democratic movement, reform movement. They said, okay, Iran is a target and we have war, so we need to be in the power. There is no time for democracy. I said that because I think it might happen again. I think President Obama kind of changed that atmosphere, tried to use the engagement diplomacy to help reform movement or moderates in Iran to gain power, especially by having Iran deal. And I think killing this deal would be a big help to hardliners in Iran to retrieve themselves and gain power again, because they always looking for a situation, crisis, and said, okay, it's now or turn to talk, military people. It's not time for democracy. And I hope this new administration follow the steps President Obama put and follow this Iran deal and not killing that.
Nina, I wanted to ask you a similar question. How do you think that the women's movement within Iran will change as a result of the changes externally in the United States?
I have to say I agree with what Vahid, the principle of what Vahid is saying is that if the current administration resorts to military force or sort of confrontational with Iran right now, it will in many ways undermine the democratic movement. It will also undermine women's rights efforts. The reason is, to empower, what's important is to empower Iranian civil society. And you can't do that by confronting a regime, because that will ultimately result in, once again, having people in Iran pay a high price for the trespasses of the regime. So what's important is, you know, the so far the effects of the Iran deal have not been felt by the average Iranian citizen. The hope was kind of a step-by-step diplomatic process which would strengthen the fabric of Iranian society, which is the people. So to penalize women, children, men, this young population for the policies of this regime will, I feel, severely undermine so many different pockets that are trying to gain momentum within this convoluted climate.
I totally agree with Nina, and I think that's important to help Iranian civil society gain its power. And I just wanted to mention this Muslim ban or executive order by President Trump. I think it's against that goal. We are kind of banning all the people from Iran, especially the students, especially artists, filmmakers, or educated people who want to come here and come back, and kind of this dialogue between two nations. So when we ban that, we cannot help civil society anymore, especially because there is no diplomatic relations. So we are just blocking the only channel between Iranian society and the U.S. society.
There was a recent report by the International Civil Society Action Network, which documents how these sanctions are not impacting the regime, but impacting the source of actual societal change in Iran. And by societal change, we mean a motion towards more freedom for the people of Iran. So essentially, this report by ICANN says that the urban has come to the conclusion that the urban middle class that has historically played a central role in creating change and promoting progress are in fact the very casualties of these sanctions. So that's, I think, something that I wanted to touch on and have us keep in mind that that is really the essence of, I think, what Fahid and I are talking about.
Yeah, thank you for that. On that note, on the flip side of that, what are some things that could empower and embolden the women's movement, and then Vahid after, we'll get to the reformist movement more broadly?
You know, right now we have a we have the presidential elections coming up in Iran, and what's important to note that women are, even though they're technically not banned from running as president, the Guardian Council disqualified all 137 female candidates who registered for the 12th presidential elections, and that specifically relates to the way the council has interpreted Article 115 of the Islamic Constitution, which says that the president should be elected from among the religious and political rijal. Now, rijal is the Arabic word meaning personalities. So the Council of Guardians has effectively ruled that this word, rijal, exclusively refers to men. It's the underlying notion that women are not capable, do not possess the same capacity as men, which is ironic in a society where women currently outnumber men in higher education. So what you're dealing with right now is, again, conservative versus moderate. President Rouhani, if he does, you know, win this upcoming election, again, it's more hopeful news for women. If the conservatives take the lead, I have very little hope, if any, that women will make any incremental gains whatsoever. That being said, President Rouhani, even though in his many campaign pledges said that women should enjoy equal opportunities, there's been very little movement within the women's movement during his time, not enough, actually, to secure Mr. Rouhani's moderate image in that sense. But again, I always say there's an extent to which he can make things happen because he is severely handicapped by the supreme leader. So I still continue to believe that as long as Sharia law is embedded within the fabric of society, as long as church and state are intertwined, there is very little hope for the women's movement in Iran.
Yeah, may I add something? At the same time of this election, presidential election, there is another election for city council. And the good point here is that I saw lots of women, especially young women, has registered for this election, and fortunately they have been approved. And I see a real movement among generally young generation and plus women movement that they want to be elected. In the last four decades, women and plus young generation always have been just voters. They didn't have any chance to be elected. Fortunately, this city council election, I think it's really important, and it shows the trends, how people think they should be involved in politics, in changing the real politics in their life. And lots of women have been registered and they are campaigning. Lots of young generation people, they are in 30s, 40s, and they are trying to be in the council. I don't say that city councils has lots of power. Of course, it's not president. But, I mean, it shows the trend in the society.
I agree, Vahid. Mm-hmm. I mean, just a reminder that this past parliamentary elections, a record 18 women were elected to the new parliament, mm-hmm. with women actually outnumbering clerics for the first time since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. The whole question is, you're absolutely correct, women are undeterred, they remain resolute, they do not surrender to the mandates, but the fact is, how much impact are these women able to actually have? How much can their voices actually be heard and implemented remains to be seen.
Rahid, I want to ask you a follow-up question on that. To what extent does the reformist movement take the values of the women's movement into its platform? In other words, does the reformist movement in any way promote equality between men and women in terms of running for office or women's rights? Or is that kind of separate from the political agenda of the reformist movement?
The point is, reform movement is not kind of a party. It's a spectrum of different groups and different political parties, if we can call them parties. So generally, if I want to say my general perception of reform movement, they completely follow the... I mean, I can say that women movement is part of this green movement, or we can call it reform movement. This reform is part of its part is what women wants: the change in the rules, the change in the, and have the equal situation for men and women. But I don't say all the people in, for example, reform movement completely believe in those ideas. But if I want to say that the general views and the trends in reform movement, I can say they follow the same ideas. And I don't see a really gap between women movement and, for example, green movement or reform movement. I try to say that they are not really different. They are generally in the same boat. They want a changing country. How change, how far we can change this situation is different. There are different answers. But generally, they want to change the rules, change the situation in the country.
I'm in full agreement with Vahid. This is a group that can be put in the same type of a progressive mentality that wants more openness with the West, more change. They don't have exactly what Vahid said, you know, concrete bylaws, but in general, and there is no universal and uniformity with respect to ideology, except for the fact that they do want change, and they want to follow a different path other than what's been.
So in 2009, Wahid, there was obviously a massive people power movement at the time of the election. And political activism has, to a certain degree, at least from the international perspective, abated in Iran. What do we see coming up with the reform movement?
We haven't seen massive protests in Iran in the recent years. But lots of people say that, okay, Green Movement or Reform Movement is dead. It's because there is no protest in Iran. But I think it's not correct. I believe there is a live movement in Iran, as Nina and I were talking about that. And daily, these people daily are fighting for their rights and goals in every aspect of life. This change, the point is that because of some lessons, some experience, Iranian people are now a little more they have more peaceful trend toward those goals. We experienced a revolution in Iran 4 decades ago, and this was not a really successful experience. Lots of people say, okay, we made a revolution and nothing happened. So maybe the revolution is not the quick answer and good answer to this desire for change. The other point is we recently had Arab Spring in some neighboring countries, and the result is not what people really wanted in Libya, in Egypt, in especially Syria. Iranians are looking at Iraq, Syria as a kind of a failed experience. One of them is by U.S. attack, one of them is by the protests or rebellion. The point is that they say, okay, we want freedom, we want democracy, but let's be sure what is going to happen after that. Let's have assured steps toward democracy. So to me, not having protests doesn't mean there is no desire, there is no attempts to have a democratic government or responsible government. It means they are trying to use the peaceful, at least the peaceful tools they have, by elections, by every other opportunity they find in the country. And it's kind of interesting when you look at the Iranian society and how they are using every opportunity in social media. They're using jokes. If someone works on the jokes in Iran, that would be a good dissertation. because Iranians are using the jokes to kind of protest against this situation. So I am hopeful about the future. I think the Iranians are following their desires and goals. But it's not like a revolution suddenly happens.
Anina, what's next for women's empowerment?
Well, what's next for women's empowerment is exactly what Vahid said. What's next is hoping for a kind of a peaceful evolution and a trend towards a more open society. I still feel that the obstacles for women's empowerment and the women's movement is daunting, and women's rights have a long, long way to go, especially in terms of legal and penal codes. But I'm always cautiously optimistic.
Well, thank you both. Sadly, that's all we have time for, but thank you so much to Vahid Abedini and Dr. Nina Ansari for joining us.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks also to Jack Lawrence for our theme music and Ryan McAvoy for producing this podcast. In the coming weeks, our team will be heading to internships and research around the globe. Podcasts may be sparse over the summer as they complete their work. But as always, keep an eye out for those subscribing to this podcast on iTunes. Visit our website at yalejournal.org and follow WIJA on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening. Until next time, goodbye.